the midweek drive, zooming into the future and energized by the now.
Well, we're almost there. Where, you might well say? Well, the holiday season. What, you mean Christmas? Yes, absolutely Christmas. And indeed, what would Christmas be without our pets? Yes, pets, because research has actually revealed that our furry friends are indeed the true Christmas angels, with new research revealing that it's our pets who are keeping us truly happy. Research by Pedigree effectively has addressed this, and we've got not one, but two fabulous folk who have joined us to discuss this today. First of all, TV presenter extraordinaire and indeed owner of Battersea Rescue Dog, Teddy, it's Andrea McLean. How are you, Andrea?
Hello, I'm really good. And Teddy is right next to me right now. So after all that preamble about how brilliant dogs are at Christmas, I'm really hoping he behaves.
I'm sure he will. I mean, after all, he has chosen you, Andrea, to be his guide in this particular world. Ah. So on that basis alone, he shows exquisite taste. Let's move on as well to our second guest, who is Battersea Pet Behaviour Expert. That's Rob Bayes. How are you, Rob?
Hello, I'm good, thank you. I hope you're okay too. Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to connect with your good self. And I see behind you, for the benefit of those people who say, yes, radio is a theatre of the mind, you've got two wonderful posters which says, ready to be loved, and two wonderful canine friends there, sort of looking at that appealingly to the whole thing. But, you know, we are very tempted, obviously, at Christmas to keep people and our pets happy from that point of view. What is it about pets in particular, Rob, that kind of brings out our inner warm, fuzzy feeling? And is it a case of it's only mammalian pets? Because if you had a stick insect, for instance, we don't get the same feeling.
I think it's I think it depends. It depends on the person, really. Obviously, you hear lots of people say, I'm a cat person, I'm a dog person. But I think if you're a pet person, whatever pet sort of you affiliate with, I think it provides that same level of comfort. I think for dogs and cats in particular, obviously, there's a huge element of sociability and companionship, particularly dogs. If you've got friends with dogs as well, they even get you at the house, they get you exercising, they get you socializing with your friends, and you can go on dog walks. And obviously cats as well, a bit more solitary, but obviously they do still provide that same level of companionship for people. And exactly like you say, around the Christmas period, that's even more heightened. I think that's even more important than ever, and especially in the last few years, we've needed our pets more than ever. So it's nice to know that so many people want to keep their pets involved. And like you say, from the research, we've seen that over 80% of people do really value their pets at Christmas and want them to be part of that Christmas period and the traditions that they have.
Andrea, tough question for yourself, given that Teddy is actually in listening range of this whole piece. 58% are considering buying their pet a present for Christmas Day to open. Will you be doing that with respect to Teddy, or is it a case of, I haven't decided as yet, it just depends what Santa Claus actually has in the sleigh?
Well, I hope he's not listening. He's asleep, so I think I can get away with it. We do normally give him a treat at Christmas, but to be fair, because for us, it's really important that we keep his routine as sort of consistent as possible. For him, what is a really big deal is actually just getting his sort of normal high value reward snacks, which is what I use to bring him back. So he has good recall if we like go out to the park and this kind of thing, or like a chew stick, which is good for his teeth. So to be honest, it sounds a bit boring. It sounds like you're giving your kids vegetables for Christmas. But as far as he's concerned, he's really happy with that. So as long as he gets them, that's all good.
Would have said it shows that you're a very responsible pet owner. And Rob, this is something I want to turn to your good self. I mean, Andrea, the quintessential responsible owner there. There is a tendency with all the excitement that's going on, particularly in family homes, et cetera, that pets might get caught up in it as well. And they can get overexcited, beg for that chocolate, and then end up choking with all sorts of other challenges. I mean, is this an issue people should be aware of?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like you say, it's you know, it's people like Andrea that we really, really want to sort of model pet ownership and make sure that obviously we're keeping our dogs safe at Christmas. But absolutely, food in particular is a big challenge around the Christmas period. And there's lots of new things in the house, lots of new foods, Christmas presents that might have chocolates in under the tree that look incredibly enticing to our dogs when they're not usually there. So that novelty really draws them in. But obviously, things like chocolate and alcohol can be quite toxic to animals, dried fruits as well, things like that. Obviously, all things that are not in short supply in the Christmas period. So it's really important to make sure that they're tucked away, food's pushed back on the counter, presents that might contain food aren't left under the tree and things like that to make sure that the dogs are nice and safe. And it's obviously, like you said as well, it's also all the excitement around Christmas. And obviously Andrea touching it with Teddy, making sure that he has his routine. That's such a key thing as well, such a key point. Making sure that your dog's routine is kept the same. They still get their walks. There's lots of people coming over, so it might be quite exciting for them. There might be sort of extra excitement that and extra energy that they need to expend. But also some dogs might find it a little bit overwhelming. They might find new people in the house, especially in huge numbers, if you've got a big family, a little bit challenging. So just making sure that they've got somewhere nice and cozy to retreat to, that's in a low footfall area, is quite a good thing as well, just to make sure that they've got that level of comfort and that they still feel nice and secure in their home, and they can still be involved in the Christmas celebrations in whatever capacity they feel comfortable to do so.
Andrea, there is obviously a history, of course, 2,000 years ago in the manger in the stable in Bethlehem. You had different animals from that point of view, although I don't think Teddy was necessarily there. Maybe he might have been in a different incarnation. But in terms of the excitement factor that Rob was just sharing with us there, how do you plan to actually ensure that Teddy is made appreciated at Christmas, but at the same time doesn't actually decide to do lots of potential YouTube videos by knocking the tree over and playing with baubles?
Well, we've learned from our mistakes, I have to say, because we're a dog family, so we've had previous dogs to Teddy. We're quite lucky in that actually he's quite a calm dog. He gets excited when people arrive, but and he rushes up to say hello and this sort of thing, and then he kind of chills out. But I have had a previous experience with other dogs. I'm sorry, Jackson, if you are listening, I am now going to totally dob you in. But we did have one Christmas where we decided to go on a little bit of a Christmas tour and go and visit different friends and family. And we arrived at one friend's house, and they had a dog. The dogs had never actually met before. And she opened her door. He rushed in, this is my dog, and peed all over her curtains. So what we, which was
Just marking out its territory, that's all.
he was, and what we then had to learn consequently was, if you are going around to someone's house or a friend is coming around to the house and they have a dog, maybe let them meet first outside so that then they do all their kind of, I don't know, chest thumping or whatever it is that dogs like to do to mark their territory. And I think we all know what we mean. Let them do that outside so that then by the time they come inside, curtains are safe. It's all good.
Yeah, I mean, Rob, some very sensible points that Andrea makes there in terms of making sure that you don't have these hyper excited folk who think, "Ooh, a new pair of backsides I can actually explore."
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's so important, especially if you've got friends and family that have dogs, to make sure that you consider how they meet each other. Like Andrea said, there's a lot of excitement around going to new places, that novelty. But also as well, for dogs that the existing dog in the home, having a new dog come in can be a little bit challenging. They're gonna have to share beds, they're gonna have to share toys, they're gonna have to share space and things like that. So just making sure that they're comfortable with each other before you then take them inside and shower them with sort of the Christmas spirit and cheer, which obviously, like I said, can be a bit exciting and overwhelming for some.
Andrea, in terms of yourself returning to this research by pedigree, where would you point people to find out more details about this? And of course, some of the excellent work that's being carried out by the Battersea organisation.
Well, Pedigree have teamed up with Battersea this year to put together the Pedigree Relief Fund, and there's a brilliant website. So have a look at the Pedigree Relief Fund website, which has got loads of advice if you are feeling a little bit overwhelmed in terms of pet behaviour. And same too with the Battersea website. It builds on everything that Rob has given you here today, and it's full of top tips to help keep your home a happy one, but maybe not an overwhelmed one.
Excellent. And almost finally, Rob, in terms of cats, because obviously Battersea looks after cats as well as dogs, are they just so laid back it really doesn't matter? They're just sort of chilling out. They don't have that hyper excitability.
Yeah, I mean, cats are definitely they're definitely obviously less excitable than dogs, and often will just take themselves off and can seem sort of seem quite impassive. But yeah, it's absolutely all the advice is absolutely relevant for cats as well. While cats might seem a little bit impassive, they don't tend to show their stress as clearly as dogs do. Obviously, dogs wear their hearts on their sleeves a little bit, and I think that's why we all love them. But cats, yeah, the cats can maybe keep themselves to themselves, and so it's still important to make sure that you set up your environment for success as well. And exactly like Andrea said, the Pedigree Relief Fund has partnered with Battersea to make sure that that advice is available to people. And as much as we have dog advice on our website, we've also also got a myriad of cat advice as well. So if there are people that are struggling or looking for how to set up their home and cat proof things for Christmas, obviously the Christmas tree is a big one. Make sure to check out the Battersea website and the Pedigree Relief Fund website, and you'll be able to hopefully find everything that you're looking for.
Fantastic, Rob. And finally, Andrea, do you have a social media account for Teddy? Can the general public follow Teddy, or is it a case of, well, he's going to be emerging as a big story in 2024?
No, he actually does have his own Instagram account. The kids set it up, so he is Teddy McPhean on Instagram. I mean, it's just basically pictures that the kids take of Teddy, but if people want to go and have a look at it, they are more than welcome to.
Absolutely. You could do a joint one, Andrea and Teddy McLean. It would probably sort of break the internet, you know. I'm just saying. Andrea McLean, TV presenter extraordinaire, and Rob Bayes from Battersea, pet behavior expert extraordinaire as well. Take care and happy holidays.
Thank you so much,
Thank you
and
so
to
much.
you.
Happy holidays.
Received the letter just the other day. Don't seem to want to know you no more. I've laid it down, given you the score. Within the first 2 lines, it must be read. You're not to come see us no more. Keep away from our door. Don't come round here no more. What on earth did you do there for? All right, she don't want to know. She says, what will the neighbours think? They'll think we don't, that's what they'll think. We don't, but I will, cause I know they. We are disgraced to the human race. He says, how can you show your face when you're disgraced to the human race? Endorsement. The intention that you have booked was an intention that was overlooked. They say stay away, don't want you home today. Keep away from our door, don't come round here no more. Our dad don't wanna know. He says this is a serious matter. Too late to reconsider. No one's gonna wanna know, yeah. Our mum, she don't wanna know. She says, I'm feeling twice as old. She said, thought she had a head on her shoulder. Cause I'm feeling twice as old.
It's an embarrassment. That was a song by Madness. Maybe you should actually avoid doing that with a bit of dad dancing. But then if you're actually in the DJ world, maybe that could be embarrassing. Maybe it's cringeworthy. I don't know. We're going to find out over the next few minutes what exactly is cringeworthy, because Premier Inn have got together with two fabulous individuals who are going to actually give us some possible solutions to how to avoid that embarrassing moment. And they are, of course, the fabulous Nick and Eva Speakman. How are you guys?
We're great, so thank, well. You. Thank you.
Excellent. And we'll, I noticed you're wearing matching Christmas jumpers as well.
Yes, we are. We're well into the festive season.
And coordinating at the same time, I hasten to add.
Of course. I mean, for radio, what else would we expect? You know, nothing less than that. It's always very good. I often think we should actually have gone back to the dinner jacket days of the BBC. But maybe that will be cringeworthy now. Listen, this survey by Premier Inn It's revealed that December is the most cringeworthy month. Is that because of the Christmas parties? Is that because we don't know what we're doing? Is it because of the embarrassing relatives, the embarrassing dads, the moment where you want to be so cool? Because let's face it, with your Instagram accounts, with your TikToks, with your X for tweets, etc., you want to be seen as the coolest. And if you're not, it can be very embarrassing.
I think, Alex, it's a combo of everything that you've just said. And staggeringly, 80% of us experience more cringeworthy moments in December.
We do. I like 80%. It is because we are socializing more, we're doing more, we're seeing more people. And so that in turn gives us more opportunity to maybe have a slip of the tongue or a physical slip or trip, say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, or even overtrying is another one, because at Christmas time, we might meet new work colleagues, we might meet our boss for the first time, we might be meeting, you know, we may have a new partner and meeting their family. And in that endeavor to make a good impression, we put more pressure on ourselves, and then we might make a little mistake. For example, there was a lady that met her husband's boss at a Christmas party recently. She shook his hand and she curtsied and said, "Oh my, why oh why did I do that?" And then you've also got the re-gifting as well, Alex, which is a one that really sort of, I think we've all re-gifted, but
not to the same person you got the gift from in the first place.
Wow.
And you've just got that, you've actually just got probably the cringiest with somebody who re-gifted to somebody that gave them that gift in the first place. I mean, that is top cringe.
I've got another one. They re-gifted a present, but the present had a photograph of them and a message from the person that gave it to them
in the first place. Yep. So yeah, so there's a lot of cringe opportunity, I guess, during the festive season, and that's most likely why we're seeing an elevated 80% of cringe moments during the month of December.
So the line about why do fish not play football, because they're afraid of the nets, as we see tumbleweed going through the whole system. Jokes that don't work. Clearly, that's a different line entirely. Oh, I still quite like that one. Anyway, what the heck?
That too.
But yeah, that is one of the. So some of the top cringes are exactly that. Well, not exactly that. I don't. Alex, Nick actually appreciates.
I might borrow that joke actually. Yeah, honestly, I've not heard that before.
But can you imagine those situations? And this is on through the research that came through, is that you might be, you know, at a party, or you might be meeting some people, and the atmosphere might be very quiet and tense. You decide to tell a joke to break the ice, but no one laughs, and so that moment becomes even frostier than it was previously. That is a cringe moment. As is slipping, you know, a lot of people, particularly in adulthood, if we slip or trip, the first thing we'll do is we fall and we look around and think, who saw me? Because embarrassment is such a key component in these cringe moments, I guess.
I mean, looking towards that, is also the notion of social encounters being even more challenging, because we have different generations mixing, and what might have been hilarious back in, shall we say, the 1990s, is now deemed to be a massive social faux pas. You just don't go there.
Yeah, well, obviously, you're absolutely right that we are mixing all different age groups and maybe people that we don't even know. So that can have a bearing on opportunities of cringe moment, for sure. But equally, you know, you're trying your best as well. And when you're trying your best and then something goes wrong, it actually magnifies how bad that feels. And then again, in the study, 40% of the people that did have a cringy moment, they actually admitted to losing 1 to 2 hours of sleep per night thinking about their cringy moment, because they're replaying it, trying to help themselves to feel better. But what they're actually doing is, the more times they observe that memory, the bigger it seems to get, because it's like exercising a muscle, and the more times you exercise it, the bigger and more profound it becomes.
And is it a case of, I mean, as I often used to say, desperation isn't sexy. And when you actually start becoming desperate, you're more likely to, again, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're trying so hard to impress that one person that you think, I really want to impress this, that, as you say, you end up either doing a curtsy, getting flustered, getting problematic. You know, there are all sorts of challenges within that.
Yeah,
very much so. You've got to remember the film Meet the Parents.
Yeah. I'm glad you refrained it in that sort of routine, because there is another phrase with respect to that perhaps could be taken the wrong way. So well done, Nick. Well handled on that one. Yeah. But yes, I mean, again, that huge personal embarrassment, especially if you're meeting people for the first time and they are relatives, presumably there are potentials for cringe on both sides.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, that quite often that we will think about this cringe moment and we replay it and we think about it. And then, but the other person doesn't even remember, because most people are very consumed with their own cringe moments or about their own thoughts and what they're going to say or do or did, as opposed to what actually happened. And yesterday that happened to us as a prime example. We met up with very close friends who we've known for many, many, many years. And we were talking about Christmas cringe. And he told us a story about him saying something in our company maybe over 20 years ago. And he said, and I still cringe about that. And honestly, truly, Alex, we had no memory of it. I don't remember it. And yet he's beating himself up about it and we remember nothing.
Well, I'm reminded of the old Bette Midler quote, which is, enough about me. What about you? What do you think about me? We all tend to be slightly more self-centered, shall we say, than maybe we think we are. It's a different line. Okay, so if people want to find out more details about this premiere in research, where would you point them, guys?
Okay, so for more information about the research and also tips to help overcome that feeling of cringe and embarrassment, if the listeners go to premierein.com/cringe, you will find everything that you need to know on there. Really interesting read, some great little anecdotes on their stories, tips, etc. So yeah, do take a look.
So it's not really a happy Cringemas or indeed a Kris Kringemas day or Kris Kringle day. It's a case of embrace your inner cringe. Would you say that's a way forward in terms of solving?
Yeah, and you know, a big thing is acceptance. You know, we're all human. We all make mistakes. We all have those cringe moments. And once you can accept them, you can let that embarrassment go.
Your cringe could be so great that you could become the cringe legend that your friends and family talk about.
And I suppose with respect to social media, that's the other hyper cringe, that these cringes, which perhaps could have been forgotten back in the day, now could be recorded and played on for as long as there's electricity in the world.
Absolutely. But then the question is, to put a positive spin on that, the question is why? It's because it is entertaining. It is entertaining. It is fun. It's nothing to worry about. And as I said, then you can wear the crown of the cringe legend.
Sounds like a possible TV series to me, guys. In terms of your own following, how can people follow Nick and Eva Speakman online?
Literally just nickandeva.com, nickandeva.com.
Well, it's been fantastic connecting with you good selves as ever. Keep on keeping on and happy holidays, guys.
And same to you. Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thank you so much, Alex. Take care.
Thank you.
Christmas. I'm not dreaming of a white Christmas. All I'm dreaming of the whole day long is a peaceful peace.
Now, it may well be that the last thing you want to do over the festive period is to actually start using technology to connect with people. And I can understand that. That's possibly actually going offline, off-grid might be a way forward. However, there are a number of folk who would actually want to connect with family and friends over Christmas. And so it's disappointing to see that one in four apparently will struggle to digitally connect. This is research by both Vodafone and the Good Things Foundation. And to talk us through this research and indeed possibly provide one or two possible solutions, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous folk. First of all, Helen Milner, the Chief Executive Officer of the Good Things Foundation. How are you, Helen?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. And we've got the head of sustainable business at Vodafone UK. That's Catherine Russell. How are you, Catherine?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. Okay, let's turn to you first, Helen, because obviously in an era where landlines are going, we're told that effectively they're moving from that point of view, the notion of actually connecting with people, friends and family, we're becoming more and more reliant on connectivity. Were you surprised by the fact that nearly a quarter of us are having problems with respect to being connected?
I am surprised. I think that it's important to show that this is about struggling to afford connectivity. And clearly the cost of living crisis has a lot to do with that. People can't afford connectivity, but they also lack skills. I think it's important that we see that as well, that they don't actually know how to, you know, save money online, how to get those deals, how to do a video call with a loved one over the Christmas period. So it's about that connectivity, but it's also about the skills as well.
And really, that's very key to the whole discussion that we're having this morning, the notion of the digital divide. I mean, Catherine, as head of sustainable business at Vodafone UK, is this something that you've noted has actually been gathering pace? I mean, you know, people used to say, oh, you don't really need to be online, you can deal without that. But actually, it's become as essential as electricity, as gas, as water. I mean, it is effectively an essential part of living in the 21st century, isn't it?
That's right. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. You know, we live all of our lives online now, don't we? It's the first thing I look at when I wake up in the morning, check the train times, the weather, those kinds of things. So, you know, and I take that all for granted. I think many of us do. So, you know, the fact that this is still such an issue is testament to, you know, the work that the Good Things Foundation are doing and the work that we are helping them with in terms of tackling this digital divide crisis, which, you know, it came to light, didn't it, in the pandemic, when we were all locked inside and, you know, being connected online was actually the only way we could really connect with education, work, each other. And we launched a program during that time to try to, you know, work in this space. So today we're in fact celebrating a milestone in that program of reaching 2 million people that we've helped to move across the digital divide in our target of 4 million. So we're halfway there.
Helen, I mean, looking at what Catherine's very capably described there in terms of how we've developed, how we've actually worked through this process, I mean, speaking personally, I tended to rely just on my work connectivity and actually didn't have any home broadband until the pandemic. And now, of course, it's an essential part of the whole process. And in fact, you know, we're using it home and in the workspace, etc. But that notion that also the way in which we book things, the way in which we actually make purchases and so on, good quality internet, and we're talking about, you know, substantially more than many people would say, yes, well, we've got some internet connection, but it's virtually non-existent. That is vital, isn't it?
It's absolutely vital to have good quality internet. And the good news is that there's a lot of investment going into that. So I know it feels like jam tomorrow, but there's investment from Vodafone and others in 5G, for example, making sure that those rural areas get really good quality internet through mobile. So that 5G rollout is really important. And the government is spending, I think, £5 billion on making sure that fixed line connectivity gets to every part of the country. So it's absolutely important that you do get access to good quality internet. and that it's affordable. So it's great that Vodafone and others have got social tariffs, so people who are on benefits can get low cost fixed line and mobile connectivity. And also, if you really can't even afford those low cost social tariffs, you can also get free connectivity through Vodafone and Good Things Foundation, through those local places that Good Things Foundation works with, those local community organisations, local charities that can provide free SIMs for people to have 6 months worth of free connectivity over that mobile network.
Catherine, in terms of the connectivity issue, I mean, in Lincolnshire, there are still areas of Lincolnshire which are patchy in terms of getting a good quality signal. I mean, you can probably get some kind of signal, but then, of course, we have to deal with the almost Zen-like cursor going round and round and round and round, or the waiting for loading a signal, etc. Is that something that Vodafone are kind of actively addressing? Because obviously there are lots of areas, part of Britain, that have rural communities where equally they do need to have access.
Absolutely, yes. We're working really hard to roll out, as Helen says, 5G, but you know, the mobile network in its entirety across the country, and recognise where there are not spots which cause people headaches. So yes, we're doing everything we can to block all of those and allow, you know, every neighbourhood, every local area, rural and urban, to have some good connectivity in a mobile network.
And you like that line of not spots as opposed to hot spots? I mean, perhaps cool spots might be the other phrase we could actually look for. Maybe that sort of suggests all sorts of other bits and pieces. Helen, people are listening to this and they are saying, well, it's all very well, the chief executive of Good Things Foundation and Catherine Russell talking about what they're actually doing, etc. How can they actually find out more details about whether they qualify, whether their family qualifies, etc., to access some of the benefits we've alluded to today?
So if people are interested in going along to a local place, so this is a very friendly, informal place, so people really don't need to be nervous or apprehensive about that, they can go to the Good Things Foundation website, so goodthingsfoundation.org/map, to find out about the great work that Vodafone is doing. They can search for Vodafone, everyone.connected. Social tariffs, people can search for social tariffs, websites like the Ofcom website, Money and Saving Expert website. They give lists of all the different social tariffs. So if people want to go and have a look at everybody's, then please do that as well. And so the social tariffs are for people on benefits. And obviously on the Vodafone website, you can find out about the social tariffs that Vodafone has there as well. So I think, unfortunately, you need to be online to be able to do all of that searching. But hopefully people listening can either do that, or they a family friend or a neighbour, or they can go along to a community centre or library and ask there for some help to search for some of those things.
Excellent. Catherine Russell, Head of Sustainable Business at Vodafone UK, and of course, Helen Milner, OBE Group Chief Executive for the Good Things Foundation. Huge thanks. And very lastly, will you be actually online yourself over the festive period, Catherine?
I definitely will. Yes. Speaking to my dad is one of the things that I love doing on Christmas Day. And, you know, I will only be able to do that on the phone. So absolutely FaceTime. Yes.
Fantastic. And Helen, presumably you'll also be connecting as well over the festive period.
Yeah, definitely. My grandson lives in Australia, so I'll definitely be singing some songs and reading some books with him as well.
Well, there you are. Happy holidays both. Take care and keep on keeping on.
Sparkling snow, get this winter over. in touch. Didn't, of course, till summertime. Out to the beach, to his boat, could I join him? No, this time it was me. Sunburn in the third degree. Now the calendar's just one page. Of course I am excited. Tonight's the night I've set my mind not to do too much about it.
Thank the Lord, she's returned. Who's returned? Stephanie Robyshefsky is back with us on the programme. How are you, Stephanie? Good to see you as ever.
I'm really well, thank you. How are you doing?
Excellent. Yeah, well, we're okay. We're getting our sleep, shall we say. Maybe not 6 or 7 hours a week, but, you know, still working with that. But we're here to talk about a recent travel trend, according to Skyscanner. In fact, Skyscanner's travel trends, which when I first saw this, Stephanie, I thought, sleep tourism. Is that not just astral traveling? Is that not just you go to sleep and actually travel in your own mind? But clearly I was wrong on that basis. So let's talk initially about sleep tourism, which seems to be on the rise. What exactly is it, Stephanie?
So it's this idea that we're actually starting to go away to help recover sleep, or even to seek out a sleep retreat where you can do a bit more than just rest and recover, but maybe fix your sleep. And it is becoming quite common. There's about 1 in 5 people who did the Skyscanner travel survey who said that they would happily go on a sleep retreat, which is amazing, really. I mean, I don't think we were thinking about these things 5 or 10 years ago.
No, I mean, again, we know that sleep is very important. We know, as we've said before, it's the way in which we recharge our batteries. We kind of reprogram ourselves. We go through all of this system. You know, Stephanie, you advise NASA on this sort of thing. So you're perfectly expert in terms of this. But as you say, 1 in 5 of us, 20%, stating that they feel the need for a sleep retreat remedy in 2024. Is this a post-COVID phenomenon?
I think that has contributed, but I don't think that is it. I think it's more, like you say, we're starting to really understand that sleep is important. It was kind of like the forgotten medicine, sleep. You know, the philosophers didn't really understand it. They thought it was a mini death. So we weren't really, you know, really looking into it. We weren't investigating it. And so what happened was there's been a massive lag and we haven't really understood, even in medicine, why it's important. Okay, now we know, but only now the public are starting to realize and get this information disseminated to them. And so with that, just a bit like the food industry, becomes like this onslaught of lots of different information, which can sometimes be a bit scary and a bit stressful. And whenever we want to do something in a good way with well-meaning, sometimes we might do the wrong things or we get a bit too stressed about it. So I can understand why sleep has become such a big phenomena that we haven't really thought about before. And also with the rise of technology and the amount of information that goes in our brains on a daily basis, our brains can't handle this as much anymore. And so we're putting a lot of pressure on our sleep, which is partly to do with emotional and memory consolidating and things like that. So this makes total sense to me that, you know, life is getting tough and a bit stressful. We're not really understanding properly how to help our sleep. So we're kind of making, you know, a bit like going on a boot camp to help with your weight loss. We want to kind of fast track, don't we? We always want something very reactive. Let me just go away for a week and I'll sort my sleep out.
One of the things we've always appreciated about you, Stephanie, is how you actually say don't beat yourself up over the fact if you're only getting 7.5 hours sleep as opposed to 8 hours sleep. Don't worry. Everybody has their own bespoke needs. Please. Is this something where, because we live in a society where we have so many screen-based cultures to work through, we've got so many doom scrolling to actually work through and so on, that actually being put to sleep in a kind of Borg-like way from Star Trek is just seen as, yeah, why not? Why can't we just press the button and I can just go into sleep mode?
Yeah, I mean, that is really interesting, actually, that you say that, though. It's like going into a Borg-like mode. And when you're away, you end up doing things that are quite different. Hopefully, most of us aren't on our phones the entire time we're away. And we're doing things that we love. And I think that's important, too. It's not about going away literally to go into a bed and sleep. It's about doing things for your well-being that end up being very good for your sleep. And just having that time to rest and be away from all the connectivity. So in a way, it's a good thing to at least recognize that you do need that. I just hope that those things sort of rub off on you and you start doing them in your daily life as well.
Now, this Travel Trends survey, Skyscanner, etc., had also suggested that one in three UK respondents say they sleep better on holiday. That suggests that two in three don't. Or am I just being too simplistic on that basis? And is the uncertainty sometimes you go to a new hotel and that first night can be a bit tricky until you kind of settle into the bed and so on?
That's really true. So it's really normal when we go away, when the environment is different, of course, because your sleep is a bit like a river. It's a flow state. It goes up and down according to so many different factors, of course. Depending on the factors that you have at home and the stress levels and the environment and how much you look after your sleep will also determine what's going to happen when you leave that environment, for better or for worse. So I would say that it's completely normal in most people for one or two nights to not sleep as well. But in most people, that will settle down. In some people, it might be worse when they're away because of the environment, perhaps because it's so different from what they've got at home. But for most of us, it will just be a couple of nights. And then actually, because we're resting and doing all the right things and enjoying ourselves, and most importantly, focusing on our daytimes, sleep will come and we're not worried about it anymore. And it's better.
Now, it wouldn't be a Stephanie Romaszewski feature on the Midweek Drive if we didn't have some of your top tips, Stephanie. And I see you've got four that you've actually put together to actually help travellers, or indeed people who are sleep tourists, get things sorted out. Would you like to take us through them, starting off with, of course, the needs to prepare beforehand?
Yes. So I think that it would be remiss of me not to say something about regulating your sleep in general, but also it's sad that you have to go away to have better sleep. Wouldn't it be better if actually you got your sleep fairly well regulated before, so that when you go away, sleep is going to be better? So getting up at the same time every day. Now, I know you've probably heard me harp on about this loads, but the issue is that's when your drive state of sleep starts. So a lot of people think they should do lots of things before they go to bed, which is going to help with their sleep. But the reality is that drive state, that ability to feel predictably sleepy at the same time in the evening, and for that sleepiness to fill in the gaps at night and make sure that you have good sleep quality, it starts in the morning. So even a few days before you go away, start regulating that time, even add in a bit of light exposure because it's such a good energy source for us. It will only reinforce that regulation that you're trying to build. And then I promise you will get more out of your sleep when you're away. If you are going somewhere that's far away and there might be a jet lag element, then on the plane, you might also find that there is time and opportunity to sleep, for example. The best thing you can do is try to have your behaviors be the same as what they will be on the new time zone. So, for example, if you're going to Australia, you want to make sure that you're eating on Australian time. So, you're not going to be eating in the middle of a Australian night, for example, on that plane. That's really important. So, try to be consistent with those things. Your body might not feel great for a few days, but your behaviors can still be consistent and on the new time zones. And then during your trip, I think it's really important to, just enjoy yourself and not to worry so much about your sleep. If you focus on your sleep, you're going to increase your sleep anxieties. Now that they not only change the chemicals in your brain at the very wrong time. So when you're physiologically trying to wind down for sleep, you don't want your body to go into panic and go into fight or flight or release adrenaline. You don't need that at that point, or cortisol. But also your anxiety gremlins, as I like to call them, they have the ability to change your behavior a lot. So when you are anxious around your sleep, you tend to change your behavior super quickly. Like, I need to do this for my sleep. I need to do that for my sleep. And you change them loads and loads and loads. And no behavioral change, no sleep change, no benefit ever happened because we're busy doing this, that, and the other and changing it every day. We have to be consistent in our own behaviors. And then you'll notice that things are a lot better.
And for those people who say, I don't want to go on a plane, I'm going to use a cruise liner or a ship, is it the same kind of scenario, except you're doing a lot more slow travel?
Yes, and also, of course, you can get a bit seasick and things like that, and that can also impact your sleep. And you can even get sort of when you got a bit of motion sickness when you get back onto dry land, which can be sort of an issue. But in general, yes, the advice would be the same.
Top destinations. Were you surprised to see Santorini, Rome, and Hainan in the top three list of places that people tend to go for a good night's kip? I mean, it's a bit extreme, I would have thought, but what the heck?
Yeah, so I was really interested in this as well. And I think that basically, when we're talking about going away for good sleep, you need to go and do the thing that you love the most. So some of us are going to go away and we want a real cultural experience. Other of us want a beach holiday. Other of us want to just walk around all day and hike and do all sorts of lovely things. So I think it's really reflective of the fact that we all need something different from our holidays. And it's not about just going, like I said, to a destination just to sleep. We want to do things, and that's going to help with your sleep at night, but it's different for all of us.
Otherwise, you'd be back into astral traveling, which is where we came in. Skyscanners, travel trends, presumably you can put into your search engine and find out the report in more detail.
Yes, absolutely.
Needless to say, Stephanie, I think the last time you were on the show, we still had Twitter. Now it's X. But in terms of other sort of areas, how can people follow the adventures of Stephanie Romoshevsky?
So I think since the last time I spoke to you, I'm now chief medical officer of a company called ReSleep, which I founded, re-sleep.com. It is a virtual insomnia clinic. So if you are struggling with your sleep and you would like some support, then please come along and talk to us.
Fantastic. And you know the last two questions, but I'll run them past you in any case. You had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on this, your return to the Madrid Drive, Stephanie Romoshevsky.
Always, I love speaking to you, Alex.
So I take it you can return in the very near future and we'll see you again in 2024.
Yes, let's do it.
It has arrived. It is with us now, even as we speak, the 2022, 2023, I should say, 24 food and drink report released by Waitrose. And some interesting aspects have come about, even in a cost of living crisis. It would seem that one in eight adults have changed their diet over the past year to eat more protein, with high protein drinks and yogurt sales up to 39% this year. Who do we need to speak to actually talk about this? Well, obviously, Waitrose's executive chef, it's Martin Lee. How are you, Martin?
I'm very well, thank you, Alex.
Excellent. So, any surprises with respect to this, or is it a case of, well, you know, clearly people need to deal with the stresses and strains of life, so they've gone for a more immune boosting comfort food option, if that's not a tautology?
Do you know what? I think you're absolutely right. And you know, in times of uncertainty, we do tend to reach out for those things that transport us back to a much simpler time. And, you know, classic comfort foods, you know, a third of our respondents in our survey have told us that they're now reaching for, you know, classics such as shepherd's pie, macaroni cheese, chicken Kievs, and, you know, even the humble spud is back on the rise, with potato side dishes up 19%. So we're definitely harking back to, you know, shutting ourselves in and eating some delicious comfort food. But I think, you know, it's the underlying drivers for me that make food trends particularly interesting. And you're right, you know, cost of living will be having an impact on this, because things, you know, like macaroni cheese, predominantly pasta based, it's particularly friendly on the wallet, but it's the physiological, it's the way it makes us feel, which is why I think it's particularly important why more of us are reaching for comfort foods.
I was fascinated by the trends over the last decade, really. I mean, the air fryer is something which, again, has caused a lot of challenges with respect to recent times. We've had families, obviously, in the pandemic era of 2021, lockdown dinners, likewise, vegan comfort food, the rise of meat-free, the right return of carbs, mindful drinking, clean eating, flexitarianism, and the one I wasn't aware of, Frankenbanking. Has that dropped off the whole agenda? Was that like a phenomenon of 2013 and never to return?
No, I think, you know, we now talk about hybrid desserts. Now we're in 2023, but you're right. You know, this is the 10th year that Waitrose have done the annual food and drink report, and there's been some fantastic and fascinating things. But the Frankenbaking, which is where we sort of started to see things like the cronut, the hybrid of a donut and a croissant, these kind of things started to appear then. Freak shakes were the next thing, with, you know, overly abundant and completely over the top milkshakes. And then, you know, halfway through this 10-year period, we then got into mindfulness and clean eating and plant-based. And you're right, even more recently, the air fryer is absolutely taken over our lives. And you know, I'm not immune to it. Even in my kitchen, I'm experimenting with triple air cooked chips and really trying to experiment. And we've launched on our party food air frying suitable instructions, because that's really important to customers. So the air fryer and Frankenbaking and hybrid desserts are here to stay.
Well, I can appreciate your triple air frying scenarios, etc. But hopefully, Martin, you're not going to say that secretly you had a fondness for pink food thanks to Barbie. I mean, you're not going to go down that line, surely.
No, sadly, I was one that managed to avoid the Barbie pink food.
Well, sadly, Martin, you should be proud of avoiding it. That's what I say.
Well, but many of us didn't, and many people did over the summer. Launch into the pink food trend. We saw red food coloring rise 25% in July with the release of that movie, which is interesting. But for me, that's more of a blip than a food trend. And when we're analyzing food trends, we have to be really careful to navigate what is a true trend that we want to go after, and what are those that are fun and we can activate through content rather than product.
I mean, technically, you could say that on that basis and rationale, Oppenheimer would have resulted in an increase in microwave ovens, you know, for kind of similar reasons, basically, you know, maybe not there, just a thought. I see that throwaway plastic coffee filters have also emerged this year as an interesting trend, which is good for sustainability.
Yeah, sustainability continues to be really, really important. And of course, we know that. And I suppose we also see that through the quality consumption of great quality meats. So perhaps we're eating slightly less meat, but the meat we're eating, we're wanting more sustainably produced, of, you know, great welfare standards. So I think, you know, sustainability is, you know, that's going to be a trend that carries on much further beyond 2023. And I think, you know, fantastic steps in that area.
As someone who does quite a lot of driving, I have to say I was quite pleased to see that there's pretty much zero, well, not zero tolerances yet, but actually zero or low alcohol drinks are increasing substantially, sales up around 23%, which is particularly good for those folk who always feel a little under peer pressure if they're the designated driver or they're at social events where they say, oh, have a glass of prosciutto or whatever, basically.
Yeah, I'm with you. I do an awful lot of driving. You know, our office is down in Bracknell, and I live just over the Humber from you guys. So I'm not unfamiliar with a big long drive. And actually, the rise of low and no is phenomenal. You're right. Our sales are up 23% in that area, and you know, one in seven are saying it's health driven. You know, being a main driver, and actually a quarter of people are saying it's due to saving money, and it's only 6% that are trying to avoid the dreaded hangover. And I think the rise of low and no is particularly interesting, certainly in my world, because it's really technology driven. The quality, the taste, and the availability of beers in particular are phenomenal. And actually, you know, you can get non-alcohol versions of pretty much every single one of your favorites in terms of beers and ciders. Wines are very much catching up, but if you think about it, they're having a lot of work on their plate to deliver, because you've got new world wines, old world wines, you've got different grapes, you've got different climates and terroirs and flavors that come through. And you think about the sheer volume of different wine types. If you don't like one, there's going to be another one you can try. We just don't have that critical mass within wines yet, but the technology is improving all the time in that area.
Post-Brexit, and I just had to mention it, do we feel as though we're actually stepping aside from Europe as a main source, or are we in love with European food and European diets as much as ever?
No, we are absolutely on board with international cuisines, and our favourite international cuisine this year is Italian. Our survey showed that it topped our survey, and you know, whether it's cooked in home or at a restaurant, it's absolutely a favorite. And what I particularly like is that it's not just spaghetti bolognese and carbonaras. There's some fantastic regionality within Italian cuisine that is really coming to the fore, whether that's Sicilian cannolis, whether it's Venetian cicchetti, or fantastic cured meats from Calabria. It's, you know, it's the regionality of Italian food that people are really starting to get into. And perhaps that's a bit of a Stanley Tucci effect, but I think it's fantastic because it's all about great quality food.
Well, it could well be Siren's sister program, Memento Vivere, which we co-host with Italian from both New York and indeed Italy. So who knows? Maybe in some small way it's impacting that. Martin, how can people find out more details about the Waitrose 2023-24 Food and Drink Report?
Yep, just need to head on over to waitrose.com. They'll find the food and drink report there.
Martin Lee, Waitrose's executive chef, huge thanks. And I say this every year, happy holidays, and hopefully you'll join us again in the very near future.
I hope to. Thank you very much.